with Andrew Childs and Zach Webb, both at IQC. And, well, I probably don't need to motivate the computer science perspective on condensed matter physics. But anyways, I have this slide. So the motivation, you know, comes from computer science, but the questions are about condensed matter physics, like what could we compute with a given system, or what could we compute about it? And for this talk, we're going to specifically focus on the task of computing the ground energy. And we're going to be talking about the computational difficulty of that task. And of course, to talk about computational difficulty, the natural language to use is complexity theory. And well, I think now I'm really going to be telling people stuff they already know. So maybe we can just flip through this very quickly. So P and BQP are the classes of problems which can be solved efficiently on classical and quantum computers, respectively. Whereas NP and QMA are the classes of problems where the solution can be verified efficiently on classical and quantum computers, respectively. And I've given this sort of a color scheme, which kind of comes out okay with this projector. And sort of as the color gets darker, the problem becomes more hard, according to standard conjectures in complexity theory. And this is going to be maybe the color scheme will be useful to remember later on, because we're going to have lots of problems with lots of shaded colors. Okay. And QMA complete problems are the hardest problems in the class QMA. And we're going to talk more about those later. And using this language, a lot of work, previous work, has gone into studying the computational difficulty of computing the ground energy for many types of Hamiltonians. So here's a summary of some of that. And there's going to be more on the next slide. But this slide is supposed to be about broad classes of Hamiltonians. So this is sort of like a crude division of Hamiltonians into a few broad classes, some of which contain others. And I guess the first class of Hamiltonians that was studied in this way is the class of local Hamiltonians, which was proven to be QMA complete by Kitaev. And it was even shown that two local Hamiltonians are QMA complete. And that result was the culmination of a series of papers. And that's the one that I've cited there, was the final one in that series. For frustration-free Hamiltonians, you can ask the question, well, is a Hamiltonian frustration-free or not? And that's this quantum KSAT problem. And depending on the locality of the Hamiltonian, the problem is either easy if the locality is 2, but is hard if the interactions are 3 or higher local. And this QMA1 is basically the same as QMA in terms of computational difficulty, which is why I've also shaded it red. The third class is the class of, it's one of my favorites, the class of stochastic Hamiltonians, which condensed matter physicists would call Hamiltonians without a sign problem for quantum Monte Carlo. And this, the problem of computing the ground energy for stochastic K-local Hamiltonians was considered by Bravi and others. And they showed that this problem is hard for a class called MA and contained in another class called AM. And I've colored this orange, which was the same color I used for NP, because these classes AM and MA are more similar to NP than they are to QMA. So this is still a hard problem, but it's sort of a hard problem with a classical flavor as opposed to a quantum flavor. And then, well, using formal mappings between local Hamiltonians and fermionic or bosonic Hamiltonians, you can show that very broad classes of Hamiltonians that involve indistinguishable particles are also QMA complete. So I've cited a couple of papers where they did just that. Okay, but as I mentioned, these are sort of broad classes of Hamiltonians, and you might ask, what about specific Hamiltonians that I care about? Well, it depends on what Hamiltonians you care about, but there have been some examples of more simple systems that have been shown to have QMA complete ground energy problems. And so here are some of those. The first at the top, and I've colored them all red because these have all been shown to be QMA complete. Well, there is a technical distinction in this Gottesman-Arani paper that I'm not going to dwell on, but well, I'm not going to dwell on it, but it's basically QMA complete. So this first example is the two local Hamiltonian problem restricted to a two-dimensional lattice. So here you have an interaction between pairs of qubits at different that are connected by an edge in the lattice, and the interaction can depend on the edge. So it doesn't have translational invariance. Those terms are sort of chosen as part of the instance. The second example in the Aharonov et al. Result, we're talking about local Hamiltonians on a one-dimensional, on a line, but with qdit, so higher dimensional particles. And then Gottesman and Arani showed that even if the Hamiltonian is translation invariant, it has the same computational difficulty. This third example is perhaps the most similar to what we study. So in this example, Shuk and Verstrata considered the Hubbard model, which is a model of interacting electrons or spin a half fermions on a two-dimensional grid. So there's a hopping term that allows the particles to move from one site to another on the grid. And there's an interaction term, which is nearest neighbor. And then there's a site-dependent magnetic field. So I've drawn this little vector B sub I. And that B sub I depends on where you are in the lattice and is chosen as part of the specification of the instance. And then finally, there's this interesting, very recent paper by Toby Cubitt and Ashley Montanaro, where they proved that versions of the XY, Heisenberg, and other models are QMA complete when you are allowed to specify a set of coefficients as part of the input. So these, I want to emphasize here that these coefficients that appear in front of each term in the Hamiltonian they're not really constrained. They can be, actually in this case, even polynomial functions of the input size. Talk about that in a moment. So a reasonable question is, you know, what is the point of all of this, or what have we learned? And now I'll list a few things that I thought of when I was preparing the talk, but of course other people might have other motivations. So one thing is that, you know, QMA completeness places fundamental limits on algorithms like quantum Monte Carlo algorithms. So we don't expect that efficient algorithms are able to compute ground energies for problems that are QMA complete. And it also guides us on where to look for new algorithms that may be efficient. So in particular, don't look at problems that are QMA complete, or if you're looking at a specific subclass of a problem where the more general class is QMA complete, then you need to exploit some special property of the subclass you're considering. QMA completeness also implies that ground states are unlikely to have short classical descriptions, or at least short useful classical descriptions, assuming that QMA is not equal to NP. One thing that I think is kind of an interesting takeaway is that Hamiltonians with no sign problem for quantum Monte Carlo have a special status and appear not to be as difficult as the more general class of local Hamiltonians. And finally, systems with QMA complete ground energy problems can be deceptively simple, even in one dimension with translation invariance. So then what is there left to do if we've already learned all of these great things? Well, it's still true that there's a lot of models that we don't know the complexity of, that, you know, in principle could, their ground states could have short descriptions. Or, you know, it could be easy to compute their ground energies, and it would be good to know if that's actually the case. One example I'll talk about in the open problems at the end, which I think is an outstanding question of this nature, is the Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet on a graph. But that's just one of many examples. The second point, well, I kind of threw this in here to motivate what we do, but I think it is actually a significant drawback of some of the previous QMA completeness results, which is that the coefficients in the Hamiltonians are allowed to grow with the system size. So I mentioned in this Cubitt-Montanaro result, there are these coefficients, and they're allowed to be polynomial functions of the number of qubits. And that's also true, for example, of the two local Hamiltonian is QMA complete result. So if you restrict the terms in the Hamiltonian to all have constant size, then it's not known, for example, that two local Hamiltonian is QMA complete under that condition. So that drawback is related to the fact that the technique used involves perturbation theory, which requires certain terms in the Hamiltonian to be larger, much larger than others. I would argue that it's desirable to consider, well, to remove that feature. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about our work. So the Bose-Hubbard model, which I'm going to define in a moment, but at a very high level, it's just a model of indistinguishable bosons which can move and interact on the vertices of a graph. And the system is defined by a graph and a number of particles. So in particular, there's no adjustable coefficients at all. The input is just a graph, a number of particles, which define the Hamiltonian. We also don't use perturbation theory in our analysis, and that's related to the fact that we don't have these adjustable coefficients. And finally, our result actually holds for any repulsive interaction strength. So I'll say what that means in a moment, but there's two terms in the Hamiltonian, one which moves particles around and one which is an interaction between particles. And if you can fix the strength of the interaction, and our proof applies to say that the problem is QMA complete for whatever choice you fix the interaction strength to be. Okay. So the plan for the rest of the talk is I'm going to give an overview of the results. I'm going to talk about the general strategy for proving QMA completeness. And then I'm going to talk about some of the details of our strategy or how we implement the general strategy in our case. But maybe I'll just pause and see if there are any questions at this moment. Have a glass of water. Okay. Okay, so, well, I guess I wanted to emphasize that the graphs we consider, it's kind of a technical point, but the graphs we consider are allowed to have at most one self loop per vertex. So they're described by symmetric 0-1 matrices. And the Hamiltonian is described using the bosonic creation and annihilation operators. And this n sub k is the number operator, so that counts the number of particles at site k. So this Hamiltonian has two terms. The first term is a movement term that allows particles to move from one site to another when they're connected by an edge in the graph. And the second term is an on-site interaction. And, well, why is it an on-site interaction? Because if you have zero particles at site k, then that site contributes nothing to the energy. And likewise, if you have one particle, then the site contributes nothing. But if you have more than one particle, there's a positive energy penalty. So that's why it's an on-site interaction. If you have more than one particle at a site, there's an energy penalty associated with that. Okay. And as you can see, the Hamiltonian depends only on the graph. Now, I haven't said anything about the number of particles, and that's because I've written the Hamiltonian in the second quantized form. But you can see that this Hamiltonian conserves particle number. So it has a sector for any number of particles that I want to choose, any positive number of particles. And so we want to consider the Hamiltonian at some fixed particle number. So let's write h bar g superscript n for the Hamiltonian restricted to n particles. Okay? Is that all right? Okay. So this is the main problem that we consider. So the input is the graph, the number of particles, an energy threshold, and a precision parameter. And the problem is the ground energy of this Hamiltonian at fixed particle number n, is it at most c or at least c plus epsilon, promise that one of these conditions hold? So this is like a decision version of computing the ground energy. If somebody hasn't seen this type of thing before, this is a standard way to phrase this type of problem. And our main result is that this problem is QMA complete. But we also have other results. So one we made a choice, which was that each of these terms has no coefficient in front of them, but we could have chosen other coefficients. Like, we could have put, you know, we could have set t here equal to 2 and u equal to 5 or something. And then it's still true that we could define a problem where every instance is defined by a graph, a number of particles, and two parameters for precision and energy threshold. And so you can ask, like, is the problem the same difficulty for different choices of these fixed choices of these parameters t and u? Now, you might point out that if I just choose t to be 2 and u to be 2, for example, I've just multiplied the whole Hamiltonian by a constant, and obviously it's the same complexity. So really, there's not two independent real parameters. On the other hand, if I multiply the whole Hamiltonian by a minus sign, then it really does change the problem, because then I flip the highest excited energy with the lowest excited energy. And in principle, it could be more difficult to compute the highest excited energy than it is to compute the lowest, or the ground energy. So really, there's a sign parameter, and then there's a parameter which tells you about the relative strength of the interaction term. And so now I'm going to talk about the complexity of this problem as a function of those parameters. So again, these aren't inputs to the problem. We're fixing u and the sign, and then we're asking what's the complexity of the problem with those fixed choices. Okay. So we're going to I just told you is that if we choose u to be 1 and we live up here in the positive sector, then the problem is QMA complete. But we actually prove that the problem is QMA complete for all positive u, and in this sector with the positive sign. Now, you could ask about the sector where you choose the negative sign. And in this sector, the Hamiltonian is stochastic. That is to say, it has no sign problem for quantum Monte Carlo. And in that case, it's contained in AM due to this result of Bravi and others. And it's also contained in QMA just by standard arguments. And then in this other sector, well, we don't know very much. What we know is that the problem is contained in QMA. Now, that sector where u is negative but the sign is positive is a little bit funny, because that corresponds to not a repulsion between the particles. The interaction term in that case corresponds to the particles wanting to all be on the same site. So it's kind of a very different problem in that case. But we don't know very much about that. Okay. So if you have some experience with these QMA completeness results, you might find this a little bit funny that our proof applies to all positive u. And so now I'm going to explain how that's the case, or at least try to explain. So, right. So first of all, if you look at this first term, the movement term in the Hamiltonian, it's not hard to see that if you restrict yourself to the sector with n particles, then the ground energy of that first term is equal to n times the smallest eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix of the graph. You should think about this first term as just being like n independent particles, all of which undergo, or the Hamiltonian for each particle is just the adjacency matrix. And so when you have n of them, the lowest eigenvalue is n times the lowest eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix. OK, so that's the first term. And then the second term, if u is positive, the second term has smallest eigenvalue 0. Okay, so it's obviously true that the smallest eigenvalue of this whole Hamiltonian is lower bounded by n times mu of g. But you could ask, you know, is it possible that the smallest eigenvalue in some cases is actually equal to n times mu of g? And if that's the case, we say that the ground space is frustration-free, because it minimizes the energy of both terms simultaneously. And it's not hard to see that just, you know, if the ground space is frustration-free, then each particle is in a ground state of the adjacency matrix, and each vertex is occupied by less than or equal to one particle. Okay? But notice that any state with these properties is a ground state for all positive u. So this frustration freeness property only depends on the graph and doesn't depend on you. So if you suppose you fix u to be 1, you can find suppose that for the graph you consider there is a frustration-free state, then that state will be frustration-free for the Hamiltonian with any positive choice of u. Okay. And so we exploit this property in our QMA hardness proof. This is a kind of a technical thing, and if you don't understand this, hopefully later on I'll make this more clear, but we design a graph so that the frustration-free ground states encode the history of a computation. And because we're talking about the frustration-free ground states, it works for all positive u. Okay. Now, when u is very large, because there's only ever one particle or zero particles at each site, the Hamiltonian is equivalent to a spin model, which has number of qubits equal to the number of sites. And so we also obtain results about this spin model. So I'm just going to tell you briefly about those and then move on. Okay. So this is a way to associate a spin Hamiltonian with a graph. So you have a graph with vertex set V, and that gets mapped to a Hamiltonian with number of qubits equal to the size of the vertex set. And for each edge in the graph between vertices I and J, that gets mapped to an operator acting between qubits I and J. Likewise, for each self loop, we map it to an operator acting on qubit I. So this is the mapping. Now, here's a little example. I hope that's clear. So there's three vertices. It gets mapped to a 3-qubit Hamiltonian. And there's, these two terms come from the edge between 1 and 2, between 2 and 3. And then this is the self loop on vertex 2. Now, we can write a formula for the Hamiltonian which arises from a general graph. And I've written that in the first line here. And then in the second line, I've just rewritten it using the Pauli matrices. Okay? Now, you can see that if you have seen, for example, the XY model from condensed matter physics before, this is a generalization of the XY model to a graph with self loops. And the self loops contribute that second term. Now, this Hamiltonian conserves total magnetization along the z-axis, or Hamming weight, in the computational basis. You can think of that as being like each one is a particle, for example. And so we can restrict our attention to a sector with some fixed magnetization, or Hamming weight. And we're going to write theta gn for the smallest eigenvalue within such a sector. And so we prove that this problem where you're given a graph, a magnetization, an energy threshold, and a precision parameter, and the goal is to determine whether or not this theta gn is at most c or at least c plus epsilon is also QMA complete. Now, I just want to comment that I mentioned earlier that it's not known that 2-local Hamiltonian is QMA complete when all the terms have some constant strength. Like the QMA completeness results that are known, certain terms are polynomially larger than other terms as a function of n. However, this Hamiltonian, all the terms are of constant strength. But it's not the 2-local Hamiltonian problem because we're restricting to a sector with fixed magnetization. So there is a slight difference there, but this is a step in the right direction. Okay. So we prove this problem is QMA complete. Okay, so, I guess now is another time to pause and ask if there are any questions, and then I'm going to talk briefly about the general strategy before going into what we do specifically for the Bose-Hubbard model. So, are there any questions at this point? Yes?
Yeah, so in the overview, you said that if there's a minus sign, then the problem is in AM and QMA.
Yes.
Does it still have MA hardness?
We don't know that it's MA hard for the Bose-Hubbard model. We have no hardness result at all. We don't know it's NP hard, for example. So that's a good question. Yeah. Okay. That's why I drew it in yellow. The one that was AM, that was in AM and MA hard was orange, and that one was yellow because we don't have a hardness result. Okay. Okay, so this is probably going to be boring for people that have seen this before, but for the benefit of others, I'm going to go through it. So how do you prove QMA completeness for these types of problems? So for example, this is like a generic ground energy problem. So you're given a Hamiltonian from some set, an energy threshold, a precision parameter. You want to know, is the ground energy at most here, at least C plus epsilon? All the problems we're considering have this form. And you know, what does it mean to be QMA complete? Well, let me just review the definition of QMA, at least in a rough, a sort of colloquial way. So QMA is a class of problems which have the following property. So if you have an instance of a problem in QMA, that means there is an efficiently computable verification circuit in the following sense. So you should think of, QMA stands for Quantum Merlin Arthur, and Merlin is trying to convince you that the answer to this problem, the instance X, so the answer is always yes or no, but he's trying to convince you that the answer is yes. Now, what he does is he sends you this state psi, and he says, listen, Dave, the answer is definitely yes, okay? But then I don't really, you know, I guess I shouldn't be Dave, I should be Arthur. Arthur says, I don't, you know, I'm not just going to blindly believe you. I'm going to run your claimed proof into my polynomial time quantum verifier. And, you know, I have this algorithm which will check whether or not your proof is valid. So Arthur runs this state psi that has been handed to him through his verification circuit and measures the output qubit and accepts if the output qubit is one. And QMA is the class of problems for which reliable verification circuits exist. So in other words, the verification circuit must have the property that if X is indeed a yes instance and Merlin is not lying, then there exists a state which will be accepted with high probability. So if Merlin isn't lying, then your verification circuit will tell you that the answer is yes with high probability, and you'll be happy. But on the other hand, if Merlin is lying, then your verification circuit should detect that with high probability. So that's QMA, a class of problems with reliable verification circuits. Now, these types of ground energy problems, why are they usually contained in QMA? Well, because, you know, if the ground energy is indeed less than the energy threshold C, then Merlin can provide to you the ground state. And you can use phase estimation to measure its energy, and you will confirm that the energy is below the threshold with high probability. On the other hand, to prove QMA completeness, it's not enough to just show that the problem is contained in QMA. One has to show that the problem is also QMA hard. What does this mean? It means that any instance of any problem in QMA, or at least this is the easiest way to prove that something's QMA hard, is to show that any instance of any problem in QMA can be efficiently mapped into an instance of the problem at hand. So that's sort of the challenge with these types of problems, is to show that they're QMA hard. And one way to prove QMA hardness that is to use the fact that any instance of any problem in QMA has a verification circuit. So one way to prove QMA hardness would be to take that verification circuit, to map it to a Hamiltonian, and if you can design this mapping in such a way that the ground energy of the Hamiltonian is related to the maximum acceptance probability of the circuit, so that if X is a yes instance, the instance corresponding to this verification circuit, if it's a yes instance, then the ground energy is less than the threshold. And if it's no instance, then the ground energy is above the threshold. If you can do that, then computing the ground energy of this Hamiltonian lets you solve the instance of the QMA problem. And so that sort of shows, you know, that's a general strategy for trying to prove that a ground energy problem is QMA hard. Okay, so, but the goal here, I mean, you know, the goal really is to come up with this circuit to Hamiltonian mapping, which has the property that the maximum acceptance probability of this circuit over all state psi is related to the ground energy of the Hamiltonian in the desired way. And just to fill the details in a little bit on sort of how this has been done in the past, so So Kitaev, to prove that five local Hamiltonian is QMA complete, used Feynman's universal quantum simulator Hamiltonian. So there was sort of a two-step mapping. The first step is to take the verification circuit and map it to a Hamiltonian where the ground states of the Hamiltonian encode the history of the computation. Okay, so this is the first step. Now, what does it mean for a ground state to encode the history of a computation? Well, it's kind of a vague term, but maybe we can just look at this specific state and I can explain to you why it encodes the history. So here the computation you can see has m gates, w0 through wm minus 1. And this state has two registers. The first register holds the input, which is that entire register on the left here, the input to the circuit. And the second register is a clock register, which can hold an m plus 1 level system. So you can see that when the clock register is in state t, the first t gates have been applied. And so, in particular, when the clock register is in the final state m, all the gates have been applied. And by looking at each of the terms in the Hamiltonian, the first register contains the state after after every intermediate step of the computation. So in that sense, this state encodes the history of the computation, which proceeds by applying this circuit to the input state phi. So that's the first step in the circuit to Hamiltonian mapping. And the second step is to add terms which penalize states where the input has low acceptance probability or where phi is not equal to psi tensor product with a bunch of ancillas initialized in the zero state. So the first step, all the ground states have energy zero, and in the second step, the acceptance probability of the circuit is related to the ground energy of the Hamiltonian. But kind of like the second step is not so tricky. It's kind of like, for our purposes at least, the hard part is going to be coming up with the Hamiltonian where the ground states are encode the computation in some way. And so that brings me to the third and final part of the talk, where I tell you, roughly speaking, how we implement this strategy using the Bose-Hubbard model. Okay, so the challenge is to encode the history of an n-qubit g-gate computation in the ground space of the n-particle Bose-Hubbard model on a graph with a small number of vertices. So it has, we want the number of vertices to be polynomial in n and g. Now, even when n equals 1, it might not be obvious how to do this. So when n equals 1, the Hamiltonian is just the adjacency matrix of the graph. And, you might ask, how do you encode a single qubit computation into the adjacency matrix of a graph? And so now, I'm going to tell you how we do that. So we use a variant of this Feynman-Kitaev circuit to Hamiltonian mapping that I mentioned earlier, which outputs a graph rather than a general Hamiltonian. I guess my plan was just to show you an example, which has a nice little graph attached. But the main idea is to add an ancilla system. The main idea that makes this work, how do we, modify Feynman-Kitaev construction so that the output is a graph. Maybe I won't get into that, but if you're interested, we could discuss it after the talk. But I will show you this example. So here is an example of a single qubit circuit, and if you look carefully, you can see that it implements the identity. It's not really important what the gates are, but they're Hadamards and Hadamard times the single qubit T gate. If you just run this through our mapping, you get this graph, which has 128 vertices, and I've kind of labeled the times in the computation, so there's sort of 8 time steps in between the gates, and those times are these sort of radial lines of vertices here. Now, Now I'm going to tell you what the ground states of the adjacency matrix of this graph are. Okay. So now the graph has 128 vertices, and those vertices can be labeled Z or Z, T, J. So they have three labels. Z, T, J, where T and J run from 1 to 8. And Z is a bit. Okay? And so if you consider the Hilbert space where every basis vector corresponds to a vertex of the graph, each basis vector can be labeled Z or Z, T, J. And that's the way that this this state has three registers, and those correspond to those three registers. Okay, so now this third register, the J register, it's you can see that in this state it's in a product state with everything else, and so that register is kind of used to implement this trick of making the Hamiltonian a graph, but it's not doing anything interesting in this state, at least. It's just in a product state with everything else. But you can see that on the first two registers, this state psi z0, you start in this input state z, a computational basis state, at time 1, and then at time 2, the Hadamard gate has been applied. At time 3, you're back to the input state because after the first two gates, the identity has been implemented, etc. I mean, this really is like the history state that I just wrote down on the previous slide, but for this circuit. Now, there is this detail that, there are these extra two states, which are the complex conjugates of the states corresponding to input state 0 and input state 1. And you can convince yourself that it's actually necessary to have those extra states hanging around. So those states you can think of as being like corresponding to the complex conjugate of the circuit we started with. So, we wanted a Hamiltonian where the ground states encode the history of the computation, and what we ended up with was a Hamiltonian where some of the ground states encode the computation and others encode the complex conjugate of the computation. But that's necessary because if you have a real Hamiltonian and you take the complex conjugate of any eigenstate, that will also be an eigenstate with the same energy. So we have to have these states lying around, and it's not actually going to pose a problem for us because in QMA, if you have a QMA verification circuit and you take its complex conjugate, that is equally useful as a QMA verification circuit. So that's why it won't matter eventually, but I'm not going to go into too much detail on that. Okay. So that's one particle. Now, with more particles, the interaction term plays a role. And as I mentioned before, we use graphs where we can understand the frustration-free ground states. That is to say, the ground states where every particle is in a ground state of the adjacency matrix and no two particles ever occupy the same site. And the class of graphs that we use are actually built from multiple copies of this graph that I just showed you. Okay. And okay, so now I'm going to tell you about some gadgets that we build using this class of graphs and what the form of the ground states of these graphs are. And I'm going to stop drawing the actual graphs because, like, for example, for a 2-qubit gate, the graph that we use is made from 32 copies of this other graph, and so it's kind of big. Okay, so now for a 2-qubit gate, we're going to be interested in the two-particle frustration-free ground states. But remember, those are built out of the ground states of the adjacency matrix. So first I'm going to tell you about the single-particle ground states, or the ground states of the adjacency matrix. So this graph has the property that its single-particle ground states encode a qubit and one out of four possible locations, which I'm drawing schematically like this. So you can think of it as like a qubit sitting at any of these four locations. Although in actual fact, the qubit doesn't sit just at that location. The single particle state I'm referring to actually has support on the middle region of the graph as well. Okay? So remember that frustration-free states are states where if you have, for example, a two-particle frustration-free state, each of the particles is in one of these ground states or a superposition of them, but no two particles sit at the same site. And the only, in this case, the way that those, you know, that extra constraint that no two particles can sit at the same site enforces that the two-particle frustration-free ground states have the form, you know, a term where there's both particles on the left and they encode a two-qubit input state phi, plus a term where both particles are on the right and they encode the state where the unitary U has been applied. So this graph is designed to have that property, that its two-particle frustration-free ground states have this form. And this is the place where we're using the property of the interaction. Okay? Okay. So now there are some challenges. I mean, you might say, okay, well, now you have a two-qubit gate. Now you can sort of like string these together and make a circuit, which is kind of the natural thing to do. But the problem is that if you attempt to do this, there are some obstacles. So for example, you might try to take these graphs for two-qubit gates and just connect them together in some way that I haven't said. And then you might ask, what are the two-particle frustration-free ground states of that? Do they encode the computation corresponding to both gates in series? And the good news is that there are two-particle ground states which encode computation. So I've started using this notation where I have like the location of the particles and then the encoded state. So there are these two-particle ground states where the particles start on the left with some encoded two-qubit input state phi, and then they move together through the first graph with the first gate being applied. And now when they're in this middle region, they can sort of move independently back and forth. But so there's these two states where one moves and then the other one moves. And then there's this state where they're both on the sort of input portions of this graph. And then when they're in both on the input portions of that graph, they can move together and the second gate is applied. So there are good states of this form that, in a sense, encode a two-qubit computation that we wanted. But unfortunately, there are also two-particle frustration-free ground states which don't encode computations, where the particles just sit in disjoint regions of the graph and don't go anywhere. And we, for the class of graphs that we consider that are built out of these 128 vertex graphs like the one I showed you, we develop a general method for enforcing constraints on the locations of particles that allows us to effectively remove these states from the ground space. And so I'm going to tell you about this general method, but the point, you can think of it, the point is to remove states like this that don't encode computations. Okay. So remember that the graphs we consider are built out of multiple copies of this 128 vertex subgraph by connecting certain copies together and then we add self loops. So schematically, that's kind of like what one of these graphs might look like. And so this lemma that we prove, what's the goal? I mean, the goal is to eliminate the possibility, for example, suppose we wanted to eliminate the possibility of having a particle in this subgraph and a particle in this subgraph simultaneously. Suppose we wanted to disallow that type of basis state, where one particle sitting in this subgraph and one particle sitting in that subgraph. Then, you know, this constraint can be described by a graph where the number of vertices in the graph is the number of these subgraphs that we have in the original graph, and an edge indicates we don't want particles to simultaneously occupy those copies. So, for example, this occupancy constraints graph indicates that we don't want to allow this scenario, okay? And this lemma that we, well, okay, so then we define the good states to be the frustration-free states of the original graph G, which also, in addition, live in the subspace where these occupancy constraints are satisfied. And, well, we prove this lemma, which takes as input a graph from the class we consider, as well as this occupancy constraints graph. and outputs a new graph from the class we consider, where the frustration-free states of this new graph are in one-to-one correspondence with the good states. And they also, not only are they in one-to-one correspondence, but they also encode the same information in the way that we want. Okay. And this new graph G prime, the number of vertices in general is quadratically more than the number of vertices in G. And that's related to the fact that the number of constraints you can have is quadratic in the number of these basic subgraphs in the original graph. Okay, there's a lot of graphs going on here. Like there's the occupancy constraints graph, there's the original graph, and then there's the output graph. Is this clear, or are people kind of on board? There's questions? Feel free. Okay. Okay. Well, anyways, we're almost at the end. So I guess, you know, our strategy is to piece together these two things that I mentioned. The one is the graph which corresponds to a two-qubit gate, and the other is the occupancy constraints lemma that lets us enforce constraints on the locations of particles. And so what we do is we take this, the original verification circuit, the QMA verification circuit, which might have n qubits and g gates, and we map it to a graph that sort of looks like the circuit, and which is obtained by piecing together these subgraphs for each of the two-qubit gates. And we also have these little things on the boundary that I didn't talk about that are kind of just a technical thing. Okay. And this graph now, as it stands, has O of G plus N vertices. But some of the ground states, the frustration-free ground states with N particles, some of them encode computations in the same way that we saw in the two-particle case. Some encode computations. But then there are others where the particles are sort of out of sync with one another, and those ones don't encode computations, and we want to get rid of them. And so what we do is we apply this occupancy constraints lemma, which is designed to eliminate these bad states that don't encode computation. And as I mentioned, this blows up the number of vertices in the graph quadratically, but outputs a graph where every n particle ground state encodes computation. So that's the overall strategy. And to prove our result, I just wanted to emphasize that we don't use perturbation theory, although I haven't really gone into the methods that we do use. Okay. And so now, that's all I was going to say about this. And I was going to list some open questions. So one of the open questions is, you know, what we allowed graphs with self-loops, you know, with at most one self-loop per vertex. But you could ask about removing that and considering simple graphs, so graphs without self-loops. And one of the reasons why that would be interesting is because you remember in this spin model that I discussed at the beginning, the self-loops actually, so here, if you look at the second term here on the second line, that second term arises entirely from the self-loops. If the graph has no self-loops, then you only have the first term, and it really just is the XY model on a graph. And so it would be nice to remove the self-loops, because then we could really make a statement about the XY model on a graph. So that's one open question. Another open question is, can we remove the restriction to fixed particle number? Now, I mentioned earlier, if we could do that, for example, for this XY Hamiltonian problem, then that would prove that two local Hamiltonian with terms of constant size is QMA complete. Which is kind of would be a good thing to know. Of course, you know, there's many other models of indistinguishable particles that we don't know the complexity of. Like, you know, you could consider bosons or fermions with a simple nearest neighbor interaction, or with attractive interactions. I mentioned this case where U is negative, where we don't know the complexity, even for the Bose-Hubbard model. Of course, you know, Gus asked about negative hopping strength. You know, what's the hardness of, for example, the Bose-Hubbard model when you have negative hopping strength? We don't know. I mean, we know it's contained in AM, but we don't know its hardness. And I mentioned also earlier the antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model, which I think would be another important example to resolve the complexity of. Okay, so I'm going to end there and pause for questions.